Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
I hope you just don't take the popular viewpoint about who Jesus is. I hope you're willing to be distinguished, that the whole world might think that Jesus is this or that, but you're going to be faithful to what the Bible says about him, and you're not going to be afraid to distinguish yourself from what the crowds say about Jesus. Say, no, I know who Jesus is. Forget about what the crowds say. Jesus phrased the question because this is a question that's placed before everybody who hears of Jesus.
Jesus asks his disciples who the crowds say that he is. And following that question, he asks the disciples who they say he is. Were they being influenced by the popular opinion? Pastor David will teach that Jesus wasn't doubtful about his ministry or insecure of what people thought about him. The crowd's opinion and even the disciples' opinion would not change who he was, but it would speak a lot about who they were. Their answer wouldn't reveal Jesus' true identity, but would reveal their hearts instead. Now here's Pastor David with part one of his message, Witness of Moses and Elijah.
We're going to begin at verse 18 tonight, but Luke chapter 9 begins with Jesus delegating authority and ministry responsibility to the disciples. And he sent them out to do the work of preaching and to meet people's needs in supernatural ways, healing, casting out demons. But again, the emphasis, as it was in the individual ministry of Jesus, was on teaching, was on preaching. But he sent them out to do the work that he had done just in his own ministry. Now he spread it out and delegated it. Well, when they came back from that experience, they were super excited. But I have a feeling not only were they excited, but they felt spent. They felt kind of worn out from that great feeling that you get when you really spend yourself in the work of the Lord, and they felt like they needed to be refreshed. So Jesus took them away to a somewhat solitary place just for a little rest, just for a little personal time with Jesus, maybe a debriefing from their short-term mission trip, whatever you want to call it. They went aside with Jesus for this particular time. But what happened? No sooner did they make the effort to get away and to spend that time all by themselves with Jesus, the crowds came upon them, and they were needy crowds who wanted to hear Jesus teach, who wanted to be healed by the touch of his hand, that wanted something from Jesus. And Jesus ministered to the multitude, and then he fed them. Thousands of them in this miraculous event where Jesus fed the multitude miraculously. Now, after that, Jesus turns his attention back to his disciples because he's thinking about the disciples, but he's also thinking about the crowd, the multitude that he just ministered to. And that sort of sets the context of verse 18 where we read. And it happened as he was alone praying that his disciples joined him. And he asked them, saying, "Who do the crowds say that I am?" So they answered and said, "John the Baptist. But some say Elijah, and others say one of the old prophets has risen again." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered and said, "The Christ of God." Notice this, as Luke loves to set the context in so many cases, in verse 18, he makes it clear that this happened while Jesus was praying. That's one of the precious things about the Gospel of Luke. He points out, more than any other gospel writer, the prayer life of Jesus. Jesus was a man of prayer. And as he was praying, all by himself, the disciples came and joined him. And I don't know exactly what that means where it says they joined him. I don't know if they joined into the prayer that Jesus was praying and they had a little bit of a prayer meeting right there. I don't know if they sort of interrupted his prayer, and when they came, Jesus stopped his prayer and asked the disciples what was going on. And then he asked his disciples, after the prayer time was over, he asked them this question: "Who do the crowds say that I am?" You men, you just got done handing out, you know, fish and bread to 5,000 plus people. You hear the murmur of the crowds. You hear the voice of what they're saying. What's the buzz? What do people say about me out there? Now, please, nobody should think for a moment that Jesus asked this question out of some sense of insecurity. It's not, "Oh, guys, do they like me? I don't know. Am I well-liked enough? How am I polling in the focus groups?" or something like that. It's nothing to do with that. No, Jesus' mentality, his approach, is something completely different at all. He's asking the question about the crowds merely as a setup for a greater question that's going to come in just a few verses. But first, let's just deal with the response from the crowds. The disciples report, well, listen, Jesus, this is what we hear people say about you. Some people say you're John the Baptist. Now, I think that's fascinating. I think it's fascinating how people who were so close to Jesus, I mean, they were right there. They ate bread that he had miraculously provided. And they go, hey, that's John the Baptist. Isn't it fascinating to you how kind of ignorant that is? That they didn't know very much about Jesus at all if they thought he was John the Baptist. They didn't know that for a substantial period of time, both Jesus and John the Baptist ministered at the same time. They didn't know that as wonderful and as impressive as John the Baptist's ministry was, it was of a completely different character than Jesus' ministry. John the Baptist didn't do anything like heal people. John the Baptist didn't do anything like the teaching ministry that Jesus did. John the Baptist didn't do anything like the miraculous and bread multiplying ministry that Jesus did. The character of their ministries was completely different. They were both, let's give them this, they were both impressive men from God, right? That's pretty much where the similarities end. They both preach repentance. That's true as well. But after that, there's not much similarity. Some said John the Baptist. Other people said Elijah. Well, Elijah is actually sort of a rational answer because the Old Testament promised that Elijah would come before the great and terrible day of the Lord. And they're thinking kind of this. This guy Jesus is pretty spectacular, but maybe there's somebody even greater coming after him. And I'm just going to guess I know what the crowds were thinking. The crowds were thinking that the greater one that would come after Jesus would be the one who would do what the crowds wanted him to do. And that was wipe out the Romans and restore Israel to a place of political independence and prominence. They were hoping that maybe Jesus was just the advance man for somebody else. Or they say one of the old prophets that has risen again. So the people are thinking, what kind of man is this Jesus? But notice this, in verse 20, Jesus turns the question back. He says, let's forget about the crowds for a moment. He asked his own disciples, and don't you think this is kind of a curious question for Jesus to ask his disciples? He asked them, who do you say that I am? Now, please remember, I can't give you exactly, maybe I should have done my studying a little bit better here tonight. I can't tell you at what point this is in Jesus' ministry. I'm going to guess it's about at the two-year point. It's just a guess, but let's just say it's at the two-year point. You have pretty much lived and eaten with and slept in the same camp. You know, you've been together with a guy for 2 years, and then who do you think I am? I mean, Jesus, what do you mean? We follow you around. We think you're a very impressive man. We wouldn't be following you out unless we thought you were an impressive man. But that wasn't enough. Jesus asked them this critical question. And might I say, this question was so important because they had to explain to Jesus, who do you think he really is? Now, the first thing I want you to understand, Jesus assumed that his disciples would have a different opinion of him than the crowds. That the crowds would think one way about Jesus. Oh, do you think they're John the Baptist? Oh, I think they're Elijah. Jesus didn't say for a minute, well, you guys agree, don't you? No, Jesus figured, these men, they know me. These men have heard me teach. These men have seen me up close. They're going to have a different opinion about me than just the crowds do. And by the way, I hope that's true of you. I hope you just don't take the popular viewpoint about who Jesus is. I hope you're willing to be distinguished, that the whole world might think that Jesus is this or that, but you're going to be faithful to what the Bible says about him, and you're not going to be afraid to distinguish yourself from what the crowds say about Jesus. Say, no, I know who Jesus is. Forget about what the crowds say. And Jesus phrased the question because this is a question that's placed before everybody who hears of Jesus. And by the way, this is what you need to understand about this question. Who do men say that I am? Who do you say that I am? It's you who are held in judgment by this question. It's not really a question about Jesus. It's a question about you. Who do you say that Jesus is? The emphasis is on you, not on Jesus. It's kind of like somebody going to, you know, Florence, Italy, and seeing Michelangelo's famous statue of David. It's a spectacular statue. You just look at it, your mind's blown. It's so big. It's so proportional. It's so perfect. You just kind of have your mind blown looking at the statue. And you say, you know, I don't think that guy was a very good artist at all. Now, when you say that, you're not saying anything about Michelangelo. What you're saying is a lot about yourself. You stink as an art critic, is what you're saying. You don't know anything about art. You don't know anything about beauty. Because the work of art stands by itself. It has its own credentials. There it is. And what you say about Jesus says a lot more about you than it ever does about Jesus. I'd say this, we answer this question every day, don't we? The way we live reflects what we believe about Jesus. Well, what was Peter's response? Look at it right there in verse 20. He says, I know who you are. You are the Christ of God. This is beautiful. Peter knew Jesus far better than any of the multitudes, far better than the crowds. He says, listen, you're the Christ. Now, do we understand the meaning of that word Christ? Christ is merely the Greek way of saying Messiah. If we were speaking in a Hebrew context, he would say, you are the Messiah of God. But since he's speaking in a Greek context, you are the Christ of God. You're the Messiah. You're the one promised of the Old Testament. You're the deliverer. You're the redeemer. Jesus, you are the one. You're the one that was prophesied way back in Genesis chapter 3, the one who would crush the head of the serpent. You're the one that comes from Abraham, would be the blessing that goes throughout the whole world. You're the one that comes from David, on and on and on. You are the Christ, the Messiah. Now you would think right there, okay, now we know who Jesus is. You know, the camera fades out, the violin music plays, and it's over. I mean, this is amazing that Peter understood it. It's like the disciples are getting it. You don't think I'm just a prophet. You don't think I'm just a teacher. You don't think I'm just a great rabbi. You don't think I'm just a miracle worker. You don't think in it. You think I am the one, the Messiah. Now, what's fascinating about that, look at the next two verses. And he strictly warned and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. I don't know. We've got to figure out a way to do this. We've got to figure out a way to wipe your memory clean of what you know about the Bible so that you can come here and be amazed by it all over again. That you would appreciate fully just how weird it is that at this pivotal moment where Peter gets the ultimate right answer, you know, he's the kid putting up his hand in the class, ooh, call on me, teacher, I know, and it's the right answer, you are the Christ of God, it's like all the alarm bells go off, yes, that's it, that's what we've been waiting to hear all the time, and Jesus immediately says in a low voice, okay, don't tell anybody. What do you mean don't tell? I thought that was the whole purpose. What good is it you being the Messiah if you can't tell anybody about it? And then he says what? And then he says, okay, guys, this is it. Not only do I not want you to tell him, you got to keep it a secret. Why? Because I'm going to go to Jerusalem and be rejected and die. Can you just appreciate for a moment how utterly bizarre that must have sounded in the ears of the disciples? I imagine them blinking and looking at one. Did you hear him say what I just heard him say? No, he didn't say that. Are you kidding me? First, don't tell anybody. What is that? I mean, obviously, Jesus was pleased that the disciples were coming to the understanding of who he was in truth, but he didn't want his identity popularly known until the right time. Why? Because it was absolutely essential that he had to suffer. Jesus was not going to allow himself to be carried to some popular acclaim on a wave of popularity from the crowds who loved him and adored him as the Messiah. No, Jesus was going to carefully manage his popularity, his fame, so that it would not crest before the time. You know, Jesus was so wise about, boy, this would be a fascinating study to do. Sometimes I think while I'm teaching, and I'm thinking right now, you don't know how rare that is. Anybody who teaches the Bible, just you know how rare that is. No, I'm just saying, wouldn't that be a great study to see how Jesus handled fame and celebrity? And right here he says, no, hands off. Don't spread that abroad. You guys are absolutely right. But listen, it's not the right time. Instead, he says, verse 22, you have to understand, the Son of Man must suffer many things. What would he suffer? Well, he'd be rejected, he'd be killed, and he'd be raised the third day. That isn't what the disciples expected. That's not what they signed on for. You know, we just had a big presidential campaign in our country, and I know people are sick of it. It seemed like it was such a long time ago and all this excitement about it and such. But it's something like this analogy. It's like you say, okay, we're finally on the campaign staff of the winning candidate. And he reveals, yes, I'm the winning candidate. We're going to go all the way to Jerusalem. And once we get to Jerusalem, they're going to reject me and I'm going to be killed. Well, who wants to sign on and work for that candidate? That seems like a losing proposition, doesn't it? But Jesus says, no, this is what you have to understand. And he says, verse 22, very demonstrably, the Son of Man must suffer many things. It's a must. Don't say, guys, this is a dicey proposition. There's a lot of opposition against me. Maybe it'll go bad. I hope it goes good. No, he says, no, I'm telling you how it has to happen. I must suffer these things. There's no two ways about it. This is appointed unto me. I must, and I also must be raised the third day. Don't miss that. It was just as necessary for him to suffer as it was for him to be raised from the dead. Verse 23. Then he said to them all, and again, just try to forget that you've heard this before. Then he said to them all, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. I imagine Jesus' disciples being absolutely dumbfounded when he said this. Okay, first of all, you ask us, who do the crowd say you are? And we tell you, John the Baptist, Elijah, one of the prophets. Then you ask us, who do we think you are? And Peter comes up with the right answer. No, Jesus, I know who you are. You are the Christ of God. You're the Messiah. You are the chosen one. And Peter gets the answer right. But then Jesus tells him not to tell anybody. Then he tells us he's going to suffer and die. And now he says that we have to suffer and die also. Why didn't you tell us this at the very beginning when we followed you? Please understand. He said to them all, verse 23 says, if you want to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. When Jesus spoke those words, everybody knew exactly what Jesus meant. In a Roman world, before a man died on a cross, he carried a cross. Let me put it to you this way. Before they hung a man on a cross, they hung a cross on him. And they made him carry that cross. And carrying a cross always led to one thing, to dying on a cross. Have you heard about these guys from time to time? They come up every once in a while. I don't know if you've ever seen one come through Santa Barbara. I don't know. Probably at some time or another it's happened. Guys who have crosses that they carry around. One guy had a famous cross with a little wheel at the bottom of it. And that was kind of his thing. And he would use it for evangelism. And he'd walk from city to city. It's just like he'd walk up and down State Street. I don't know if it was literally on State Street, but in some community. Take a cross and walk it around with it and use it to talk people about Jesus. Let me tell you something. I guess whatever, if that's what you want to do and it gives you an excuse to talk to people about Jesus, whatever. But I will say that's nothing about what Jesus spoke about here. Because in the Roman world, you carried a cross for one reason, because you were being led to death. The original hearers of Jesus didn't need this explained to them. Everybody knew what it was to be crucified. Everybody knew that the cross was one thing. It was an unrelenting instrument of torture, death, and humiliation. Let me say those things again. Torture, death, and humiliation. That's what the cross was all about. And if someone took up your cross, you never came back. It was a one-way journey. You never walked away from the place of crucifixion with the cross. You only walked towards it. What else is bizarre about this? If you look at the phrasing that Jesus there, he says, if any man takes up his cross, if you take, you must take up your cross. In the Roman world, nobody, at least in the sense that Jesus spoke, took up a cross. You just go, hey, I'll carry that. You know how crosses were distributed in the Roman world? They were forced upon men going to be executed. You never voluntarily chose the cross. It was forced upon you. And Jesus says, no. In my kingdom, you have to choose this cross. You have to embrace it and say, yes, this is going to be something that I choose. I am going to take it up. Now, I know what you're kind of thinking, okay, this swimming, humiliation, death, torture, what is this all about? Jesus, what do you mean? Well, he gives us a clue here in verse 23. Notice what he says there. He makes two equivalent statements. He says, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily. Jesus is making an equivalency, sort of a parallel between those two ideas. To deny yourself is something like taking up your cross daily. The two phrases express, at least in this context, somewhat of the same idea. You see, the cross wasn't about self-promotion. The cross wasn't about self-affirmation. The person who carried a cross knew they could not save themselves. I am destined for death. That's what you knew carrying a cross. I don't mean to sound flippant about it, but if you were a newspaper reporter and could walk up to a man in the Roman world carrying a cross to the place of execution, excuse me for sounding flippant, but if you interviewed him as a reporter and said, well, what do the next 12 hours look like for you? I mean, there's one answer, death. I'm going to die. I have no future. My future is completely out of my hands. It's been overwhelmed by a will that's been impressed upon me. And Jesus says, no, this is why I want you to choose to live that way by denying yourself. To live, if you could say, as a God-centered person, as an others-centered person, and then only finally that, after that, a self-centered person. Think of that very simple way to phrase it. God, others, self. How many of us practically live our lives exactly flip that around? Self, others, God. Jesus said, no, you got to flip that around. And doing that in some way fulfills this idea of taking up your cross. Now, by the way, daily. Verse 23 says daily. This shows that Jesus was not saying, and just so everybody's clear on this, nobody should think for a moment that Jesus said, okay, well, I guess if I got to go to heaven, I got to literally die on a cross. No. You cannot die on a cross daily. That's a one-time proposition. Daily shows that Jesus is speaking in a spiritual sense here. No one could be crucified literally every day, but daily you can have the same heart, the same attitude that Jesus had. Ladies and gentlemen, you could say this is discipleship at its very simplest. Jesus carried a cross, you should have the same mentality. Jesus completely abandoned himself to the will of the Father in his life. You and I should do the same. Now you could almost imagine Jesus looking at his disciples, and as he makes this radical statement, you got to deny yourself, take up your cross, follow me. You could almost picture the disciples going, what? Why? Why, Jesus? So he's going to explain, verse 24. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what profit is to a man if he gains the whole world and is himself destroyed or lost? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, of him the Son of Man will be ashamed when he comes in his own glory and in his Father and of the holy angels. But I tell you truly, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God.
Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Enduring Word Radio. Over the years in Christian media, we've seen all sorts of misrepresentations about supporting ministries. Everything from give your last dollar to if you don't give, God's work won't be done. These sorts of manipulations are not biblical, and they do not represent God's heart for giving. Here at Enduring Word Radio, we want to run fast and far from these sorts of misrepresentations. That said, it's also important for us to be faithful to share with you the ongoing financial needs that we do have. Enduring Word Radio is heard all over the United States. The program that you listen to today was professionally produced, and purchasing time on some radio stations comes with a cost. So we want to be sure to at least inform you and ask that you seek the Lord about supporting Enduring Word Radio. there's a secure option to give right on the homepage of enduringword.com. You can give a one-time gift or partner with us on a monthly basis. Again, that secure option to support Enduring Word Radio is available at enduringword.com. In closing, our thoughts on ministry is where God guides, God provides. God is faithful, and He will continue to provide for Enduring Word Radio. Again, thanks so much for joining us today for Enduring Word Radio with Pastor David Guzik. It's our hope and prayer that today's message has been a blessing to you. Until next time, may God bless you and keep you.